You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
It is Monday, July 25th, 2016. I am Michael Brooks on a Michael Monday on the Majority Report, pinch hitting for Sam Steeter. On today's program, we are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Stephen Cook, senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, is going to explain what the hell is going on in Turkey. I mean, we need to figure it out, folks. Coup, counter-coup, massive suppression over there in a NATO country at a time when the very nature of NATO might be in flux with the possibility of a Trump presidency. Of course, last week we saw the Republican National Convention display of paranoia, white nationalism, terrible optics, poor show design, and the nomination of one of the greatest buffoons in American history to the Republican Party's candidate for President of the United States. Hillary Clinton responded by naming Tim Kaine, the rather unexceptional Virginia senator. Not a surprise, but a disappointment to progressives just hours before a massive WikiLeaks data dump of internal DNC emails proving what everybody already knew. The DNC is run by inept hacks who, of course, favored Hillary Clinton over Bernie Sanders. Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who is success in politics in some ways, is mystifying if you're optimistic about politics and sadly confirming if you're cynical about it, is out as DNC chair, but in an important sounding position in the Hillary Clinton campaign. That might be more symbolic than anything else. Mike Bloomberg, well, I guess Trump is just too much for him. Although I wonder if he and Peter Thiel will explore getting into the human harvesting industry together. He's endorsed Hillary Clinton and apparently will have a speaking spot at the DNC. Later on, we'll be also talking with Sam, who is in Philadelphia, where he will cover all of this madness. Plus, there's the Russia angle on the DNC leak. Are they really behind it? Is this an effort to help Donald Trump? Well, that's what the Clinton campaign is pushing. And regardless of that specific theory, there is no doubt that Donald Trump is pretty close to the Russians. We'll get into that. It's an interesting story. It's definitely part of Russia's foreign policy strategy to back people just like Donald Trump. So another week, another step to the implosion of the American empire. And if you were watching and listening with us last week, as someone on Twitter pointed out, he expected us to be waking up in a Mexican hotel room with duffel bags and suitcases of money handcuffed to our wrists, mafia and cartels chasing us, and with no memory of what had happened. But all of you have memories, and I have been tweeted to be reminded of some of the select moments of the evening, some of which specifically involving me. Good times. Good times were had by all. DNC will be a lot more staid in all senses of the word. How you doing, Matty Leck?
I'm good. I think I'm more or less recovered from last week.
It wasn't just that we were seriously drunk. It was also that it was a soul-deadening experience.
Yeah, what you're subjecting yourself to for 5 hours a night.
It was genuinely horrifying, even by the standards of people who are already overexposed to all of this garbage. If you want the opposite of the Republican National Convention, subscribe to Two Dope Boys in a Podcast. Fresh one dropping tomorrow with my friend Waz, who's a podcaster over at ESPN. And, of course, Phil McKenzie and, of course, super producer Matt Leck. Last week we had shows on with Clover Hope from Jezebel. And recently did a great interview, our own interview with Rana Faruhar. So if you're not already on it, had a great review recently of a guy who said, you know, I resisted listening to this for a while because I thought I was too Midwestern for it, too square, but I love this podcast, and now I listen to it with my morning coffee. Loved it. Okay, everybody, we are going to go straight to Steve Cook. We'll be back in about, a minute or so on the Majority Report. Me can defend myself anywhere me there. Sure. Everybody know I got some sense. You can't beat me like your parents. That I got cause of no interference. So. You never fear them, never, never fear them. And this when me then near them, send the grizzle beer them. Them coulda never pay me fi fear them. Them a talk but me still not hear them. Them coulda never pay me fi fear them. You know she say y'all don't be sure scared them. Me not pre badness, you know. Me a pre some pounds fi go leave, you know. No boy never diss me when me a pick me. That means I me not take this, you know. I coulda be them a try pre cool, you know. You disappear if you disabula, a yo. The lane and the main get full, you know. Nobody no believe it, but you shoulda know. You never fear them, never, never fear them. This when me then near them, send the grizzle peer them. Them coulda never pay me fi fear them. Them a talk but me still not hear them. Them coulda never pay me fi fear them. You know see say y'all don't be sure see them. This a Gaza story. No fear nobody, so me granny show me. You shoulda never, never act like you know me. The boy shock when he woke up in a Kobe. Them a scream like Milka, like a Jody. The league too big, them a flutter slowly. Me married to the game, what a matrimony. You know bad like Mooney, him a me roadie. Real yard man. You never fear them, never, never fear them. This when me then near them, send the grizzle peer them. Them coulda never pay me fi fear them. Them a talk but me still not hear them. Them coulda never pay me fi fear them. You know see say y'all don't be sure scare them. You never fear them, never, never fear them. This when me then near them, send the grizzle peer them. Them coulda never pay me fi fear them. Welcome back to the Majority Report. I am Michael Brooks. That was PopCon and Vibes Cartel. People have also been tweeting, asking for specific... they want to know what music is being played. I don't remember the name of that song, but I do remember the artist. Joining us now is the artist of international affairs himself, my good friend Stephen Cook, who's a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, a good friend of mine, as everybody knows. And also, Steve, I should have warned you, but I'm just going to drop this on you now. I think it's fair to say now, senior Turkey correspondent for the Majority Report.
I've gotten two new things today. I'm the artist of international affairs and the senior Turkey correspondent. I love it.
Yeah. I mean, look. All right. I'm not going to do a Trump impression. I'm sorry. I'm sure I'll do it eventually, but I have to ground myself here. So, Steve, it's a good idea to counter-program a little bit. I mean, everybody obviously just saw this sort of utter insanity of what's happening in our country last week. But, you know, we haven't had a chance to talk about what happened in Turkey just, you know, about, I think about 8 or 9 days ago at this point. There was an attempt at a coup. It was put down. And now we're living with the consequences of that. Before we get to that, can you explain to us your best understanding of who was behind that coup, what the thinking was, and why it didn't work?
That's a great question, Michael. And the problem with knowing, I think, let me start this way. I don't think we're ever going to really know what happened. The government is framing the narrative as the Gulenist movement. Followers of a Turkish cleric named Fethullah Gulen, who lives in Sailorsburg, Pennsylvania. He's been living there for quite some time in self-imposed exile. That the followers of Fethullah Gulen concocted this coup attempt to overthrow Erdogan and the AKP government. this is, to some extent, a self-serving narrative, given the fact that Erdogan and Gulen had at one time been partners in Turkish politics, right. Silent partners in ways, and have been in open warfare with each other since 2013. And each other's followers have been going after each other in a variety of different ways. The other narrative, is that opponents of Erdogan argue that, in fact, the Turkish government, at Erdogan's direction, staged this, in their narrative, alleged coup d'etat,
right.
And staged this putting it down because in order to advance Erdogan's agenda and to finally do in the Gulenist movement. I think, obviously, these are two extreme narratives. And I think it's more likely and more plausible that what you had was disaffected Turkish military officers responding to new fissures within the officer corps that have emerged during the AKP period. Careerists who knew their careers were probably going to be coming to an end soon. And some Gulenists, although the Turkish government's claim of almost 200 Gulenist generals doesn't make any demographic sense. And that they came together as a confluence of interests, and they undertook a coup that was not executed well or successfully. I guess that's the same thing. And now we're living with the consequences to which you alluded to, which is a counter coup and massive purges of the judiciary, the ranks of academia, the ranks of teachers at all levels, the military, the prosecutor's office, the judiciary, thousands upon thousands of people have been purged. People have been jailed. As Erdogan continues to hammer home this narrative that it's Gulenists and Gulenists nestled within all aspects of the bureaucracy that have sought to bring Turkey low.
Right. So we'll get back to that because it's very disturbing. It certainly fits a pattern with Erdogan and his leadership. But you have a piece in The Atlantic called How Erdogan Made Turkey Authoritarian Again. And you sort of review, I think that there are these kind of three competing poles of at least power Turkish politics. I mean, there's a variety of political forces in Turkey. There's, you know, there's Kurdish nationalism. There's a left that has been very suppressed. But it seems to me that, you know, of the sort of dominant forces in Turkish political life, there is some sort of continuum of the old Kemalist sort of generals and secular elite, which ran the country for many years. And then there's this rise of Erdogan and the AKP, which began as sort of conservative Muslim, but somewhat democratically oriented. And then the sort of through line, which cuts in between all of these groups and creates all sorts of different divisions and distinctions, is the relationship of Turkey to joining the European Union and how Turkey will be relative to the European project. Now, I'm just wondering, in this piece, you go back and you sort of trace the history of that and how it relates to coups and counter coups and sort of democratization of Turkish political life. So, first of all, do those threads make sense? And then can you kind of situate that history for us?
Yeah, those threads absolutely do make sense. And that you have Kemalists, both civilians and military officers, who played an enormous role in the founding of the country and its subsequent development. And as a result, developed vested interests in the way in which the country developed and its particular politics. And then you have the rise of these Islamists. Now, Islamism had been a feature of Turkish politics for a long time, but the AKP, which is an outgrowth of previous Islamist parties that had been closed by that Kemalist elite, has been extraordinarily successful electorally. And in the kind of first version of the AKP rule, they pursued European Union membership with vigor and undertook wide-ranging sets of reforms to the extent that the European Union offered Turkey an invitation to formally begin the negotiation process to join the country. Now, the EU really has had a dynamic effect on Turkish domestic politics. If you ask AKP's leaders at that time why they were undertaking these reforms. They said, because we want to get into the European Union. And what it did was it altered the interests of these two big actors in Turkish politics. First, it provided enough incentive for Turkey's new generation of Islamists to achieve what they wanted to achieve, which was a secularism akin to the kind of secularism that you have here in the United States, an opening to the world. And membership in the European Union provided opportunity for them. Previous Islamists had railed against the European Union. And then because the European Union, prospect of European Union membership was so popular with average Turks, that it actually constrained the military from undoing these reforms, because although the military had often set itself out as kind of, you know, pro-modernization and democratization and so on and so forth, they had always come up with excuses as to why Turkey actually really shouldn't be in the European Union, or that if it was in the European Union, it should get some kind of special considerations so that it doesn't have to fundamentally kind of alter its political system to adhere to EU norms.
Right.
And that produced, that combination of these incentives and the constraints on the military and the new interests of reformist Islamist Muslim Democrats, or whatever they called themselves at the time, created this dynamic where there was some genuine reform. But since 2007, Erdogan's fear of a Kemalist establishment backlash, he believed that there was a coup coming around every corner. He sought to vanquish his opponents, both real and perceived, and you started to see the reversal of this reform. There was no longer the Erdogan of kind of consensus building, very pragmatic, to someone, a politician, who believed that he was responsible for the transformation of Turkey and only he could do it himself. And the AKP, instead of being this dynamic Islamist party, really became a vehicle for this ambition of then Prime Minister, now President Erdogan.
Yeah, so and now we would actually look to an example like in, you know, Tunisia for potentially more of an actual expression of this type of sort of Muslim-flavored democratic party. The two, you know, and so those are actually lead me to two questions that I want to get to before we get to the, you know, the what's happening now and then actually specifically what's happening with you, which is pretty stunning. But the two kind of connected questions are, and you alluded to in 2007, it was the Ergenekon case. And I remember that I was in Turkey when this first started to break, when some of the initial arrests were made. And, you know, I was a college student studying abroad. And the first, you know, there would be a story here and there like, okay, we, you know, there was some, you know, warehouse in Istanbul that had some massive weapons cache or something like that. And, you know, and people started getting arrested. It might be a surprise to some people outside of Turkey, but like, you know, a journalist, an academic, generals, but actually if you sort of understand Turkish politics, it's very plausible that the military, mafia figures, some journalists, some academics might be involved in some type of coordinated effort to remove a government like the AKP. Then as it went out, and you kind of alluded to this, it seemed like he started just basically saying like, hey, you, and you could say like, hey, Steve, what's going on? You'd be like, hey, what's up, Tayyip? And he'd be like, you're part of that Ergenekon thing. And you'd be like, what's that? And he'd be like, don't lie to me. You're going on trial next week. Like, it became a massive umbrella to sort right. of, he took a real thing and made it into a fake thing.
Right. Oh. That's exactly right. It became a conspiracy within a conspiracy within a conspiracy. Mm. And you nailed it right on the head that, you know, when this was revealed, when this plot was revealed, which it did exist, there was, you know, this weapons cache in a warehouse in Istanbul uncovered in June, I believe, of 2007. You know, a lot of Turkish liberals breathed a sigh of relief. They said, finally, we're going to get a look at the national security state, the deep state, and start rooting it out.
Right.
But Erdogan quickly, along with, I should say, his partners within the Gulenist movement, saw this as an opportunity to undermine the military and others, not in a democratic way, but in order to use these accusations to go after their political opponents. And people were jailed. Careers were destroyed. There was a follow-on case in 2010 called the Sledgehammer case, which specifically targeted the military and essentially decapitated the senior command of the Turkish armed forces. So this became an effort to undermine every possible group that could that Erdogan perceived as a threat, that had its own separate base of prestige and authority and potential power. And since that time, there has been a very clear, at first people started calling it an illiberal turn in Turkish domestic politics, but I think it's become clear, at least since the Gezi Park protests in 2013 and the government's response to it, that this isn't just, you know, some kind of veering from a path, you know, a temporary kind of illiberal turn, and that this is, you know, a full-blown authoritarian system, that this is a one-man elected autocracy, and that the organs of the state are being used to advance his agenda. Now, he says his agenda is pure. It's about, you know, creating opportunity and altering the Turkish system that
figuring
has
out what the hell's going
groups.
On.
But, you know, just the means don't justify the situation.
Of course. So, I mean, but then my other question related to that before, when we'll get right up to date after that, was the AKP always a shell? Or is it something that he sort of internally inside his own party structure? I mean, he was obviously always the leader, but is this something
right.
that he's muscled his way towards? Or was it always just a kind of, a shell for his ambition?
Well, you know, that's the subject of debate. There are a lot of, you know, Turks and other analysts who say, you know, Erdogan was never a Democrat and the AKP, this was always what they were about. And I think that, you know, it's hard to know what's in someone's heart. Erdogan is, of course, the guy who once said that, you know, democracy was like a trolley. You could get off whenever you want, whenever your interests serve. But I think it's clear between when AKP was first elected in 2002 and that 2007 elections in the summer of 2007, when they won 47% of the vote on the shoulders of a very broad coalition of people, that this was a dynamic party led by a charismatic leader who was interested in the modernization of Turkish politics and, importantly, modernity, in that he had this vision, allegedly, of a Turkish society in which you could have an emphasis on religious identity and religious values that was perfectly commensurate with a officially secular political system and democratic political system. That's what people believed. And the evidence up to that point was, hey, maybe these guys really are capable of doing this. And it attracted liberals and Islamists from all over the Arab world who went to Istanbul and Ankara to see what the secret sauce of this Turkish success was. Since 2007 and 2008, as a kind of cult of personality around Erdogan, as he became more concerned about the establishment striking back, as they have leveraged Turkey's political institutions in order to undermine their opponents, the AKP has really become a vehicle for Erdogan and his ambitions.
Now, Steve, we talked before about this pattern. And I just want to say parenthetically, in some respects, that, you know, the lesson for us, and this is another debate, but I know we'll talk about this in the future as well, you know, there's some people who are very attached to using this as another case study in the pure incompatibility between any type of Muslim identity and democracy. And that may be its own separate debate. I think, you know, obviously we're, you know, pretty secular. But that said, and it's very important to note, that Erdogan is reverting to type not as a Muslim political identity, but actually in some ways is unfortunately a very traditional Turkish political identity. That's why you call it a re-authoritization of Turkey. But that said, what's happening right now? It sounds to me like it's almost like the Ergenekon case on steroids. Like the crackdown is incredibly brutal. There's nothing subtle about it. There's a lot of reports of, you know, police detaining people, you know, physically, you know, abusing them, torturing them, keeping them without food, you know, academics getting removed from universities. this seems like a whole other level.
It is a broad perch of all of the places that Erdogan believes people might be plotting against him. I mean, there's no other way to describe it. But let me just go back to, before I get into the Trumpitas, let me go back to one thing and highlight it and underscore and underline what you just said, that when we see what's happening in Turkey over the course of the last decade, it's not because Turkey is a country that's 99.8% Muslim. It's because of authoritarianism.
Right.
Erdogan is an authoritarian. He's actually used his piety and a language, a religious vernacular to advance what is essentially an authoritarian worldview. Those things don't always go hand in hand, but he's used them successfully. Now, onto the purge, what's happened in Turkey over the course of the last 9 days is akin to the kind of purges that the military undertook after its coup in 1980, which was their effort to protect the state from individuals. And what we're seeing now is an effort to protect Erdogan, the AKP, and the party's a vision for society from those who disagree with it. There's no doubt, I think, in anybody's mind that this Gulenist movement, which is, Gulen claims to be, a liberal Islamist about peace and good brotherhood, and, there's an extensive network of schools, and so on, but they also do operate in the shadows, and they have done extra constitutional things and illegal things in order to advance their agenda. Erdoğan and Sledgehammer be two primary examples of it. And so it stands to reason that there were Gulenists who have sought to place themselves within the bureaucracy and alter the character of the state. But this massive purge, 20,000 teachers, all university-level academics have been told that they may not leave the country, may not go to conferences. The attacks on alleged Gulenist bookstores, the reports of torture at the hands of the police and AKP supporters, and Erdogan's whipping this kind of thing up is disturbing, to say the least. Now, there's a lot of pushback coming from the Turks saying that these are fabrications and the Western media just doesn't understand and so on and so forth. But, these aren't just Western journalists who have an axe to grind. I know some of them who cover Turkish politics. I don't believe that Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch have an axe to grind. If anything, Turkey's been treated relatively easily by a lot of these organizations over the course of, the last however many years or so.
Right.
Turkey hasn't been a focus of them. Although I must say the Committee to Protect Journalists has been really on top of Turkey. This gives you an idea of how far gone they've gone. Yeah. On a per capita basis, Turkey has jailed more journalists than any other country on earth.
Right.
So it's quite a sad and dangerous situation in Turkey right now.
So, Steve, I don't know how much you want me to, sort of get into this, but this is to give a sense of the sort of reach of this paranoia. You're someone who I think it's very clear by all the conversations that we've had, certainly, and all of your writing and everything else, that you're not in the, obviously, you're not sort of pro AKP or whatever, but you're someone who I think has given a very, very sincere effort to give them a fair hearing. And even when you write these pieces now, it's like, this is just what's happening. You can't stick your head in the sand, but you're still even writing in some respects, I sense like more in sorrow than anger. This piece in The Atlantic has led to all sorts of a piece apparently that ran about you in Turkish media. You're getting these tweets coming at you, which I'll just sort of paraphrase. This is one of the more gentle ones. Maybe your opinions are under the influence of illegal Gulenist terrorist group which attempted coup in Turkey. You should search well all the Gulenists. They can manipulate you and play with your honor. Other people say that you're an effing coup supporter and that you support terrorists. And I just want to apologize. I was drunk when I set that out, Steve. But you know, but I mean, it's kind of incredible. Like you,
I mean,
you're at an important DC institution, and you're an important. It's not like you know you're a notable figure in all of this, but the range at which they're saying we need to rip apart a you know pretty fair-minded American analyst, it really gives you a signal of what's going on.
Yeah, I think, and that's right. I mean, this is not about me. I think what the attacks and threats that I've gotten over social media and by email and other ways is reflective of the direction of Turkish politics and the cult of personality around President Erdogan, who, I have tremendous respect for his political skills, and I've always made that abundantly clear. But what's happened is, in Turkey, like in Russia, Erdogan and the AKP have managed to wrest control of what was at one time a fairly rambunctious media. It wasn't always the best media in the world, but it was diverse and fairly rambunctious. And now they control more than 3/4 of all the media outlets, so that they control what Turks hear, what they see, and what they read. There is a virtual ministry of information. Along with the control over all these different media outlets, there's an army of Turkish Twitter trolls. So not only am I being attacked by people who are known to be Turkish Twitter trolls, but by just average Turks who've taken to social media to accuse me of all kinds of crazy things. There was a piece, and much of it, you know, up until I started writing about the coup attempt on the day after, and I've had 3 articles about it since then. And up until this weekend, it was kind of the run-of-the-mill stuff. I've grown used to, you know, Turks responding in threatening or obnoxious or taunting tweets. But the Turkish state wire service, the Anadolu agency, or the Anatolian agency, ran a piece about me, which was basically a fabrication and a total misrepresentation of what I had said in a variety of these articles. And that's when the threats got really, really, really serious. So there's an effort, not just in Turkey, but abroad, to delegitimize, threaten, intimidate those who might suggest that Erdogan and the AKP are pursuing the coup plotters and pursuing their interests in a less than democratic way.
You know, before we wrap up, we only have a couple minutes left, Steve. I mean, is there anything, you know, how do you take that personally? Like, are you concerned about it? I mean, I understand in terms of what's happening in Turkey, but in terms of your own experience of it, what's the kind of response?
Well, I mean, it's sorrowful. I love Turkey. I love Istanbul. It is one of my favorite cities in the world after New York City. And I don't feel like I can go back there. In addition to the fact that the kinds of tweets and the kinds of things that Anadolu wrote about me in the piece might encourage people not just to take to Twitter and social media, but actually seek to do me some harm. So, not to make a mountain out of a molehill, but, you know, for the time being, I'm trying to, you know, keep a watchful eye on my surroundings when I'm wandering down the street rather than, you know, doing what I normally do, which is not really pay attention to what
listen
I'm doing.
To Vibes Cartel,
that kind of
star fights.
And I'm not doing the Pokemon thing as I walk down the street this week. it's a bit unnerving for people. And you read, you know, the chamber of the two.
Yeah, I don't want to sort of feed the energy of the, but it gets a lot darker. Yes.
Yeah. So I appreciate you asking, but again, it's not about me. I think it's really reflective of the way in which Turkish politics has gone over the course of the last 7 or 8 years.
Final question, Steve, in the last minute or so. Do you find back to the sort of Turkish context, but it bridges, actually, because you're getting this disgusting harassment on social media. Part of this crackdown over the last several years, pre the purge now, was and very much connected with a physical and brutal breakdown, crackdown on Gezi Park environmentalist protests.
Right.
But has been, you know, a real intense attempt to control social media. Erdogan, if we don't believe the conspiracy theory version that he staged this, but if we believe that he actually put it down, he used FaceTime on an iPhone to tell people to go out into the streets and protest. So the two mechanisms that he's been attempting to destroy, he used to save himself. Any comment on that irony?
Just the ironies of ironies. I mean, it was striking when he did that, in addition to the fact that the Turkish state, you know, news organizations or those affiliated with the government or those that are supportive of the government use social media to devastating effect, to attack their opponents, to intimidate them, to encourage violence, against them. I was witness to the Gezi Park protest, and it was the same kind of thing where the government decried social media. Erdogan, you know, likened it to Satan, but at the same time sent out thousands of Twitter trolls, thousands of tweets from government officials, from the head of, you know, Turkish radio and television's Turkish service, attacking people, myself included, for just, you know, basically, I was a witness to it, so I felt a responsibility to report what I was seeing and hearing.
Yep.
And I wasn't the only one who faced that kind of thing. So yes, the ironies of ironies. We once thought these things would be extraordinarily liberating, and they were during the uprisings in the Arab world in 2010 and 2011. But there was a dark side, and authoritarians really have managed to leverage these same technologies to establish political control over their societies.
Well, Steve Cook, I appreciate your time as always. Steve Cook's a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. He's an artiste of international affairs. He's a senior Turkey correspondent on the Majority Report, and he's also my paisan, my amigo. And together, we figure out what the hell is going on. So, Steve, thanks so much. I'll talk to you again soon, man.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Michael.
All right, brother.
Take care.
See you soon. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Okay, everybody. I believe... Samuel Lincoln Cedar will be intruding on the phone lines in a matter of seconds. And so we're going to just sit here and hold it tight until he does. I don't know if he's inebriated. I'm not inebriated. Unlike, wow. Yeah, I don't want to keep sharing more of my personal life on the show. But regardless, yeah, well, or having it shared for me. But I was out and about this past weekend, and I didn't really have a chance to look back at any of the clips. So But I did look at one, the one that was like during Mike Pence, Majority Report goes downhill.
Yeah, that's
and I didn't even like listen. I just looked at us for like a minute, and I was just like, wow, that's pretty real. That was some actual drinking was taking place. That was definitely not just like, yeah, man, we're gonna get drunk and watch the convention. It was actually literally like, our world is dying, and we are inebriated.
Well, once Sam kind of gave up on any decorum,
yes.
then everybody else got to stop pretending.
Well, that was incredible though, because Sam went
Kelly,
from,
I heard that.
Yeah. You know it's true.
I don't think I gave up on any decorum. I think America did. And ooh. I think followed suit.
Fair enough.
Fair. I think it was appropriate.
I did think the thing about your efforts around creating an artistic reflection of Mike Pence and Ted Cruz might have been the reaches of no decorum.
All right, but I don't know why we're talking about that. That was the second to last night of the convention, and we did have a last night of the convention where I thought we dialed it back. We brought it back into... Yeah, we did a great job.
What's going on there?
I don't know what you guys... Well, I've just been sussing out Media Row. How does this sound, incidentally?
Sounds great.
Really?
Yep.
Yeah, it sounds fantastic.
Fantastic. Oh, okay, great. I'm shocked, but I'm also happy. So
no,
I'll take that.
Yes, go with that.
I am at the Radio Row. I've been around the convention. The convention is held at the Wells Fargo Center, which is this big complex, and apparently I think there's like a what appears to be like a basketball arena, and then next door to like what appears to be like a bigger baseball type of arena.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, baseball and football.
Baseball and
football. I have Will Durst here just to tell me when I'm saying things that are incorrect.
okay.
That's the thing that happens when you come to Radio Row. They assign you someone to help you out, and I was fortunate enough to get Will Durst.
Will Durst is a great guy. Does a fantastic job. Everybody says
yeah,
it.
I get a legendary satirist. Other people got stuck with some other people. I'm not going to say who, but I was pretty happy with mine.
Sad.
It's total fluke. Yeah.
Are people pissed about the leaks? I mean, are people already coming in angry about those things or no?
Well, I don't know if you saw the video of what took place with Debbie Wasserman Schultz. Have you played that?
They're playing it like right when we get into the fun half, yeah.
Okay. I mean, there is most of the people inside this building that I've come across, people that I have met over the years, there is a universal feeling of like, she needs to be out of, I mean, I've been saying she needs to be out of the state. I actually think they should like,
yes.
She needs to leave Pennsylvania. but there is this sort of exasperated feeling. I mean, here's the thing. The Clinton campaign does not have the ability to unilaterally say, get out of here. Right? I mean, they can go and sit down with her, but I think there is probably some measure of, I don't know. I don't know. I mean, really what needs to happen is President Obama needs to get on the phone with her and say, like, look, whatever you're doing, go away.
Well, like, they insulted him in those emails as well. I mean, you know, it's not nearly as sort of offensive as what they did to Bernie, but they said something about, you know, his fundraising efforts were effing stupid. I mean,
right.
He certainly
could
get on the phone with her and say, you're messing everything up.
The emails, I mean, from my perspective, I don't know. There's not a lot of people around here that are upset about the emails per se. I mean,
right.
Certainly, I think, because I'm here, I'm only dealing with people who are sort of periphery to the whole process, right? I mean, these are the people reporting on it.
Right.
But clearly, I was talking to David Dayan, who was at that delegate meeting in Florida.
Oh.
And I'm going to talk to him more over the course of the week.
Great.
On air.
Great.
But he said that there is a tremendous amount of anger that is coming from the Bernie supporters. Now, you don't know what numbers is represented, but there was a protest yesterday with 1,000 people. I mean, already we're talking about more people than we're protesting at the RNC.
Yeah.
And I don't know. From my perspective, the emails were not terribly surprising.
Well, they're not.
I mean,
that's sort of exactly what you'd expect, right? Condescending, dismissive. They prefer Hillary. Sure.
Yeah. Well, they also did the same thing to, like, I was talking to Ari Rabenhoff and a guy named David Guggenheim, who's the program director, one of the program directors over at Sirius, and they wouldn't offer up Debbie Wasserman Schultz to any of these serious shows because supposedly he was a Bernie bro, and he's just the radio programmer. I mean, he's not.
That's
he's
a
not,
real
you know,
stretch.
I mean, well, and so I mean, there's a tremendous amount of incompetence there, and I don't think again, you know, I was having this argument with Jess McIntosh a year ago on Hayes' show.
Yep.
They clearly were indicating that they were trying to help Clinton. And, you know, it's not terribly shocking. Every institution is going to have some biases. Did they make a difference? No. I mean, I don't think they did. I don't think they had the ability to do that. I think, again, the biggest thing was the way they scheduled the debates and not even the timing of them, but the number of them and sort of saying that you couldn't engage in another debate without sacrificing your slot in the sanctioned debates.
Right.
But, you know, Debbie Wasserman Schultz has got to go. She's got to go.
In every way.
In every way. And from what I've talked to with people, nobody seems to like her very much.
Right.
But she has a, she's a, um, she gets, she's a good fundraiser, and so everybody was basically punting, just saying like, what difference is it going to make? Well, now it's come back. I mean, this is like, you know, this is the problem. You don't leave, I mean, look, there are times I open up the refrigerator and I see like, oh, there's a banana that's rotting, but I'm too lazy to deal with it. What's the worst that can happen? And then like a week later, I look and the banana has actually like liquefied. And so it's like all stuck on the glass.
The rotting banana, right? Theory of W. Wasserman
The
Schultz.
Rotting banana. And so it's all like stuck on the glass. And then I'm like, you know what? Now I know why I should have gotten rid of that banana at the time. Even a rotting banana in your fridge can cause problems. So that's my point. She needs to be gone.
What about
and
Tim
my
Kaine?
Understanding
Do you have thoughts
is,
on that? Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Well, yeah, let's talk about it in the, I mean, Tim Kaine was, you know, also sort of to be expected. And I think, you know, the W. Wasserman Schultz thing makes it worse. I mean,
much
when
worse.
You think about the reforms that have taken place, in 4 years, the superdelegates, the number of superdelegates is going to be one-third what it is today. One-third.
Yep.
That's huge. For people who had a problem with superdelegates, that to me is a huge reform. 700-some-odd superdelegates in 2020, there's going to be 250 that are not bound by how their state votes. I mean, this is good stuff.
Yep.
But it's getting completely quashed here. Tim Kaine comes out and says he's now against the TPP. That's good. I don't know if I believe him. I don't know if I believe her. But we now have both of them. It's prominent enough that he's got to do this on day one. These are good things.
Well, and that literally they leaked and told the story that was actually part of their, like, some of their phone conversations, that she was pretty much like, I want you on board, but you need to flip on TPP, basically. And he's like, yeah, I agree with you. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't meet whatever standard. So that shows where the
absolutely.
Muscle is. Yep.
Absolutely. So, you know, these are all good things that we should be celebrating. And instead, we're watching Debbie Wasserman Schultz, I don't know, argue for, I don't even know what. I don't know what she's doing.
Rotted banana.
And the only upside to this is that I hope that it helps Tim Canova.
Right.
But let's go into the fun half, and then who clapped?
Yeah, we'll go in the fun. Yeah, you just tell me. Yeah,
that was me clapping.
We'll go into the fun.
Tim Canova.
Oh,
that was, Kelly likes Tim Canova. All right, everybody.
Wow, I had no idea Kelly was such a Tim Canova fan.
Of course. What are you talking about? Debbie Wasserman Schultz is a blight on my social media.
Well, I've seen his poster abilities. That you keep in your locker. I just didn't realize that it was
that
political.
Deep?
Well, I didn't think you wanted it to be that. I didn't know you wanted to blow her spot up like that, Sam. Become a member of the Majority Report today. Majority.fm/become a member. What else should we plug, Sam, before we go to the fun half? JustCoffee.coop, Fair Trade Coffee, tea, chocolate. Get the Majority Report blend. Leave us a review on iTunes. That always helps. If you're going to use Amazon, do it through our link. Go to Majority Report Kickback and also Jet.com, which is the socially responsible version of Amazon. Okay, we'll see you all in the fun half.